you call me, 'cause I can't go.
16 tons, and what do you get? Well, I know what you get. You get The Attitude with Arnie Arneson on WNHN 94.7 on your radio dial. And you know that if you go to our website, WNHNFM.org, you get a streaming live and get podcasts and RSS feeds of all our shows. And we were very lucky to have the former governor of the state of Vermont, Madeline Cunin, on the air, and the former dean of the Tuck Business School, John Hennessy, on the air, talking about end of life. Yes, it was death with dignity, and Vermont was the first state to pass it legislatively. So before I introduce my guest, I'm going to do two things. As I tell everyone, you really should join our Google group, The Attitude with Arnie Arneson Radio Show, or check us out on Facebook. Why? Because I always have really wonderful additional content. Not only do I tell you about our scheduled guests, but I also give you articles that relate to our scheduled guests. And I also have things like the haiku of the day, the quote of the day, you name it. My tweets, you know, I found Twitter, God help us. But I thought I would share my three haikus of the day, because they kind of go a little bit with the conversation we're about to have. And then I will give you one of my tweets, which directly goes to the conversation. Here are the haikus of the day. Thank you, The Economist. Jobs are needed now. Austerity ill-timed. Action is required. That was by Jeff Miller. Here's another one from The Economist. No one has a job except econo bloggers. And they're not paid much. That was from Felix Salmon, who I adore. He's hilarious. He writes for Reuters. And then the last, the U.S. need jobs. Politicians have theirs now, with which they do little. And that's by Austin Frank. So I wanted to share that. And then before I toss to our guest from Canada, here is the tweet that was based on the article that I read that he wrote. In the 1920s, top 1% controlled 40% of public debt. In 2010, top 1% controlled 40% of public debt again. They control the wealth and the debt. Great. With an exclamation point. Now, who taught me this fabulous statistic is the gentleman who's joining us on the line from York University. Let me welcome to the program a PhD candidate, Sandy Brian Hager, the title of his piece, America's Real Debt Dilemma. Welcome to the program, Sandy. How are you?
I'm good. Tony, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So, if you have never listened to this radio program, we talk ad nauseum about the growing gap between rich and poor. We talk about how successful the economic return has been for the very wealthy and how it really has not been able to be shared by most folks in the middle or at the bottom of the economic structure. We've talked about the fact that we are at the lowest tax burden in 60 years and that the rich refuse to sort of take on any additional burden. They not only take on additional burden, they manage to squirrel their money away in the Cayman Islands or a Swiss bank account so they don't pay anything. And if I hear about one more mega corporation that pays nothing in taxes, I think I will vomit. So when I read your paper, I was like, oh God, I didn't even think of that either. So why don't you share with my audience about the piece you wrote, America's Real Debt Dilemma, because you look at the current crisis and you look at it with a different lens. So share with my audience what you were looking at and what conclusion you have come to.
All right, that sounds like a plan. I guess I'll just start by outlining some of the general arguments that I make in the paper, and then, time permitting, maybe we can get into some of the specifics and some of the technicalities of the arguments that I'm making.
Mm-hmm.
So
perfect.
The basic starting point for the research is just to engage with these debates that are taking place right now in the U.S., and those debates have to do with the explosive rise in public debt that we've seen since the onset of the current crisis. And just to give your listeners maybe a bit of background information, in 2007, right before the onset of the current crisis, the U.S. public debt, it stood at 64% of GDP. And in 2012, it now stands at 103% of GDP. And this is actually the first time that the U.S. public debt has breached the 100% mark of GDP outside of World War II. And of course, this explosive rise in the public debt, as we know, if we read any major newspaper, it's attracted a lot of attention. And it's led to this fierce and actually very polarized debate over who should bear the burden of repaying these massive levels of debt that the U.S. federal government has accumulated. And so on the one hand, you have groups such as the Fix the Debt campaign, which is, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with it, but it's
isn't that Pete
affiliated
Peterson?
With the billionaire tycoon Pete Peterson,
yeah, exactly.
And it's backed by all the large corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And what that Fix the Debt campaign argues is that the public debt should be reduced through cuts to social spending programs. And so basically they advocate austerity. And on the other side, you have groups like the Flip the Debt campaign, which emerged in response to Fix the Debt and which is loosely affiliated, I guess, with the Occupy movement. And what Flip the Debt argues is that the debt should be reduced through tax hikes on the super rich. And so the super rich have had the most to gain from the regime that's been in place since the early 1980s, and so they should be the ones primarily responsible for reducing the debt through, you know, paying more taxes on their capital gains and on their income.
Mm-hmm.
And this question of whether the debt should be reduced primarily through tax hikes or through spending cuts, that's been dubbed by the Financial Times newspaper in Britain as America's debt dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm primarily referring to in the title of my paper. And so what I'm arguing in my research is that this current debate about the U.S. debt dilemma, it really ignores some fundamental questions about, I guess, the power relations that underpin the very existence of the public debt. So in other words, what these debates ignore is the question of who are the dominant owners of the public debt, who are the winners and losers associated with the explosive rise in the public debt. And so what I do in my research is I examine these power relations. And the way that I do that is just by mapping the share of the public debt that's owned by the top 1%, the infamous top 1% of U.S. households. And you already pointed to the data in your introduction. I think they're quite remarkable. So
I just want everyone to know that when I looked at the graph, and I went back to this is 1920s. This is before the crash of 29, everyone, remember? So again, we were at a place where there were these incredible group of very, very, very wealthy people that were controlling a lot of what was going on economically in America. And you see them controlling not only the income wealth, but they're also now controlling the debt. And then you see the numbers tumble. They go down. And then all of a sudden you see the numbers starting to crawl up. And in 2010, you see a parallel experience to 1920. And you go, you want to vomit. I mean, you just go, what is this about? And the graph is so powerful. And it's one I have never seen, ever, ever. So my compliments to you, Sandy, for even noticing it, because I think it's another storyline that not only do they may drive us into debt, but then they actually also own the debt. Oh, all right, keep going. I guess a couple of the questions I have is that, so you're looking at the sort of power struggle because, you know, who are the winners and losers here? So talk about who are the winners, you know, going in to create the debt, and who are the winners who own the debt? Because it sounds like it's the same boys and girls.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, the people who create the debt and the people who end up swallowing up all that debt as investment, I imagine they are more or less the same people. But I think one thing that's very interesting about the research is just that it runs counter to a lot of what we're led to believe about the relationship between the top 1%, the rich and the wealthy in America, and their true beliefs about the public debt. So if you read the mainstream media, we're constantly told that they're opposed to big government and to a large public debt. And I think this research actually brings that claim into question, or at least forces us to make a more nuanced argument about the relationship between the rich and powerful and the public debt, given the fact that they own and control so much of it.
So are you telling me that Pete Peterson is really lying? That he, I mean, or are they doing a cost-benefit analysis? What would we gain more? Would we gain more if they actually address the debt and they would actually pay off some of this stuff that we control? Or would we gain more by ensuring that we basically are never taxed on our incredible wealth and the wealth that we're able to get, you know, in a multinational way? So what they're saying is, this way we divert attention from tax increases, we focus on the debt, and what we're basically doing is saying to the poor and the middle class, you should eat it all.
Yeah. I mean, as far as Pete Peterson and his Fix the Debt campaign are concerned, I'm not sure of their, you know, what's actually going on inside their head, whether it is a cost-benefit analysis or just outright lies. But if you look at the Fix the Debt campaign, if you go to their website and look at the actual platforms, what they're actually, you know, proposing in concrete terms, they're not really focused on debt reduction per se. If you look at any of the things that they prescribe, they prescribe, first of all, spending cuts, so austerity and severe and drastic cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And then they also advocate a tax reform plan, which would end up broadening the tax base, but would actually end up cutting tax rates, even for those at the top of the hierarchy. And so what I argue in my paper is that this whole business of Fix the Debt being about debt reduction is actually misleading. What Fix the Debt actually prescribes is austerity and fear-mongering about the public debt and about budget deficits. That's just a smokescreen for Fix the Debt to push through what it really wants, and that's an austerity agenda, which would end up, in the end, exacerbating this deepening
So here's what I'm curious about. Why did the rich people want to screw everyone with this austerity budget? No, in the end, do they not need us anymore? I remember years ago, you know, they kind of needed us to buy a car or to buy an iron or to buy a washing machine. But are the rich so disconnected from what people need, what people buy, that they live in another space where if the economy is trashed and people are starving and they're not able to function and they're not able to purchase and they're not able to go to school, that's perfectly fine with them? They'll still be rolling in cash and no matter what happens. I mean, isn't there a connection between wealth and what happens to the economy and the rest of us? Or have we totally disconnected what happens in the economy to most people and what happens in the world of the 1%?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. It's not one that I have any, you know, profound answers to, but I think if you look at, say, you mentioned the issue of offshore and there's also the issue of the transnationalization of wealth where, you know, the ruling class, the top 1%, can basically own shares and stocks and bonds all over the world. They become less and less wedded to what happens within the U.S. itself. There's also, I think we have to sort of clarify what's going on within the top 1% as well, because you do have even struggles going on there as well. So people like Pete Peterson, they obviously are 100% behind the austerity agenda. But then you have more enlightened members of the top 1%, such as Warren Buffett, which, you know, Warren Buffett keeps on saying constantly in the New York Times that, you know, I want to be taxed more. I think that the tax regime that we have in this country is unjust. I think taxing me would be, you know, a great solution to bringing down the debt. So it's very complicated, and it is the most important question, because I think there are elements of the top 1% that you know, are guilty of exactly what you're mentioning, is that they can't see that, you know, some sort of form of equality might actually benefit them. And then you have more enlightened members like Warren Buffett who I think are at least taking right steps towards fixing this situation.
I look at all these diverse numbers that I keep getting thrown at me. And we did a discussion last week, Sandy. We're talking with Sandy Brian Hager. He has just written a piece called America's Real Debt Dilemma. You are a PhD candidate, am I correct? Is it Knox University? Is that what it is? York University in Toronto. So as we're talking, a couple things come into my head as you're talking about the real debt dilemma. We had a conversation about the increase in the minimum wage. And if we had just increased the minimum wage at the rate that we were able to do starting in 1978 to today, it would be about $9.25, $9.50 compared to where it is. So it would be about a 20 to 30% increase in the minimum wage. And one of our callers called in and said, you know, if we did that alone, every single dime or dollar that low-income person received, a significant portion of it would go into the Social Security Trust Fund. So if we had just kept pace with 78, we would see a swelling, a of what they're bitching and moaning about, because they say, oh, it's going broke. What are we going to do? I'm not even talking about raising it above the, what is it, $116,000, whatever that number is, that is actually applied with the FICA tax. I'm talking about just giving the bottom something a little bit more to keep them solvent and maybe less dependent on government. But in the end, look at the bills they could pay, not just the rent, not just the electric bill, not just the food, but they'd be able to pay more into Social Security. And no one has ever made that connection, you know, that if you're worried about the trust fund, isn't it ironic, pay people at the bottom more and your trust fund would do better. You know, it's and yet the rich, if you gave them a 30% increase, not one penny of it would help the Social Security Trust Fund. Not one penny. They could be making $300,000 more or $3 million more, and not one dime of that would impact the trust fund. So there's an irony here that we have no idea how we got into this debt dilemma. We have no idea who owns the debt, and we have no idea that the people that sort of got us here and own the debt are once again asking not to be responsible for fixing it.
Mm-hmm. What you're proposing would actually end up redistributing wealth and income, and that's something that there isn't, as far as I can see, a lot of enthusiasm for in the U.S. right now. Obviously, the Occupy movement and similar movements have really started to draw attention to these unequal power relationships in U.S. society, but if you look at what gets proposed within the sort of machinations of the federal government, none of this really comes to fruition. And just to sort of make the story a bit more depressing. In the paper, I discussed the distribution of transfer payments. So those are transfer payments that people receive from Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, mm-hmm. and from voucher programs as well. And as you saw in that analysis, the bottom 40% of the U.S. population has actually seen its share of those transfer payments plummet quite dramatically since the 1970s. And so what we're ending up with is not only just a more unequal distribution of quote-unquote market income, but also of transfer payments as
How
well.
Is that so possible? How is that possible, Brian? I did see that. How is it possible that we are getting poorer and we are struggling more? And as a result, you would assume that the transfer payments, they'd be receiving a greater portion of those transfer payments because they have a greater need for Medicaid. They have a greater need for whatever it is, Social Security or food. How come the amount has decreased? Explain to me how that math worked.
I don't have a very good explanation for why it happens. I was actually just interested in mapping the data because I don't think anyone had actually done that before. But I think it goes along with the broader trend that we've seen since the late 1970s and the early 1980s, where you know, there has been this massive upward redistribution of wealth and income towards the top 1%. And so as the upper echelon of U.S. society increases its control of income and wealth, it starts to exercise more power, and that leads to more regressive legislation. These things go together very well. I don't want to say that yep. the distribution of income and wealth exactly determines what happens in politics, but I don't think it's a coincidence.
I linked to your piece, and I want them to look at the graph that you just described, the share of transfer payments to the bottom 40%, the share of transfer payments to the 60th to the 99th percentile. They are going to see the lines cross and go in absolute opposite directions. Starting in about 1995, the top sees an increase, and the bottom is just continuing on a horrific downward slope. And isn't it fascinating? We're looking at a fight right now about the ag bill, the big agricultural bill that funds Cargill, really, and ConAg more than anyone else. And what is stopping the agricultural bill from going forward, the farm bill, is that the Republicans don't want to include food stamps. They don't want to feed the poor. Okay? So they not only do they want austerity, they want them to starve, and they figured if they're hungry enough, they might find a job. That's what this is about. How hungry do you have to get to go to work? Now, if you're a mother who's disabled with two kids, imagine how hungry she'd have to get. I mean, I'm looking at the fight, and I'm looking at the logic, and then I'm looking at the share of transfer payments. Someone should send this graph to every member of Congress and say, explain this to me.
Because sadly enough, the data is freely available to them through the Congressional Budget Office, but no one's actually bothered to put it in graph form, I think partly because it is a dirty little secret.
Well, it's going to be fascinating. I sent your piece to a couple of people. One of them is going to be joining me on the air tomorrow because I want other folks to look at the data. I want them to see what you plotted. I wanted them to respond to it because what you are pointing out is their answer of fix the debt, their answer of austerity only creates greater havoc and greater insecurity in this nation. And if enough people understood that they would be totally shafted and harmed by this, I can't imagine an electorate would continue to vote for members of Congress that want that kind of result, but they have no clue. And as you just pointed out, Sandy, yes, that information is available from the Congressional Budget Office, but you had never seen anyone plot it. Why does it take someone from Canada to plot the story of America?
I'm not too sure why that's the case, but hopefully this is some small direction in just getting people to think in alternative ways about the public debt. We do hear a lot of fear-mongering, oddly enough, from both Republicans and Democrats about the public debt, that the U.S. is going to end up, you know, as the next Greece if it doesn't get its fiscal house into order. But once we step back, I think, and just look at whose interests are served by that public debt, then we have to come up with new solutions. And as you know in the paper, I don't propose any concrete solutions, but what we need to do is put the discussion of public debt back on the terms of inequality, looking at issues of inequality and how they relate to it. Because obviously this is probably the issue of the time for the U.S. and for many other countries.
And I'm going to let you go, but Sandy, here's the most important thing. You don't offer solutions, but we didn't even know the facts. So therefore, if you're kept ignorant and you're not aware of the facts, and you don't see those graphs, then you're going to embrace a solution that hurts you because you don't have knowledge. And what you have just started to do, just with the two graphs that I'm looking at right in front of me right now, it sends a totally different message and picture than what we hear from Pete Peterson's group. It basically calls them liars, is what it does. And you don't necessarily intend to do that, or maybe you did, but I think if with this ammunition and people were aware of it, I think then what we would find in the way of solution would be very different than the kind of austerity that they're basically preaching, because that kind of austerity only does more damage.
That's right. Yeah, that's the whole purpose of the article. So I'm glad you picked up on that.
I did.
It's great to be able to come and talk about these things with progressive and intelligent people.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. And I'm going to make sure this paper gets circulated a lot, honey. I'm just telling you right now. All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you,
bye-bye. Ciao, bye-bye.
That was Sandy Brian Hager. The name of his piece, America's Real Debt Dilemma. You've got to please look at these graphs on this thing. Marty, you are going to plot. I'm just telling you right now, it was so depressing as I was looking at it. And I'm going, people don't even know. They don't even know. You have to see the numbers going literally in opposite directions. And you would think a transfer payment, well, you would see a greater embrace or opportunity to absorb these transfer payments to low and moderate income people. But it's the very wealthy that saw the benefit of transfer payments. There's something sick here. I'm just telling you right now, there's something sick here. And the fact that he had never seen a graph like this, he said, so the numbers were available, but no one had ever plotted the numbers. I'm sending this to Dean Baker. I am. You know, at the Center for Economic Policy, I'm sending it to Dean Baker. I'm sending it to Think Progress. I'm sending it to a bunch of people saying, you better know these numbers. So they control the wealth and they control the debt. And then the way they want to fix it is then they want to control absolutely everything and the rest of you be damned. It's disgusting. It's disgusting. I'm so upset. A wonderful, wonderful piece, everyone. Can I tell you why I feel honored? So I had someone from York University on the air with us a couple of weeks ago, and the head of the economics department said, listen, one of my students just put out this paper. Maybe you want to read it. Do I love it? But again, the question, why do I have to go to damn Canada to find out what the story is here? What are we afraid of? Why aren't we curious? Why aren't we asking the questions? Why aren't we connecting the dots? Why does Sandy connect the dots but not someone else? You know, I mean, that's the part. Where's, you know, I want to send it to Tuck Business School and say to Tuck Business School, explain these numbers to me. Do you discuss this with your business students? because they're going to be the moguls of business that are going to be, you know, holding Pete Peterson's hand. So just a great piece, everyone. I really encourage you, I beg you to take a look at it because I think it's really important. And then last but not least, I was mentioning that I found Twitter. I'm up to my 95th tweet. Oh, my God, I'm getting prolific. And I told you that one of the tweets was based on the conversation we just had with Sandy Hager, right? And it was, in the 1920s, the top 1% controlled 40% of public debt. In 2010, top 1% controlled 40% of public debt again. They haven't done it since the 1920s. So guess what, boys and girls? They control the wealth and the debt. Great! Exclamation point. Now, here's my other tweet. And the reason I'm going to share it with you is that I have a new follower on Twitter. And my other tweet is, who cares more about potential government abuse and overreach, Carol Shea or Annie McLean? Based on NSA phone tracking vote, it's Carol Shea. Because Carol Shea voted for the amendment and Annie McLean voted against it. My new follower on Twitter, Annie McLean. So I'm just telling you, it's very depressing to me. So as I brought this up, he reminded me, go to ArnieArneson.org to follow me on Twitter, to find out my bio. Brian is wonderful about that. Really, please do that. You will get to know exactly how Arnie's mind is thinking. Go back and look at some of those tweets. I'm telling you, there's a book there. It's not just Twitter. There's a book there. But before I let you go,